This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we talk with the Federal Reserve Bank president about why he's holding town halls to hear from people about the economy.
Hey, here's how our job market is. Here's what we're seeing in prices, and it's important for me to hear directly from them.
We'll find out more about that canceled risk analysis on Enbridge Energy's Line 5.
The risk analysis was just not going to be usable.
The legislature passed a budget this week. We'll hit some of the highlights.
I think what's most interesting about this budget is that it's a reflection of what we're seeing with the economy, this kind of like slow prodding, slow growth.
And getting help for victims of human trafficking is harder than it needs to be.
People really want to find out what's out there. There are lots of problems for people. They report not being able to refer individuals to mental health services, to rehab services.
All that. Plus, we'll hear about the Detroit Historical Museum's exhibit of the 1967 uprising. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Nearly every week you'll hear something about the Federal Reserve Bank, but how often do you think of the Fed in your local economy? Well, Neil Kashkari wants to change that. He's the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. It serves the 9th District. There are 12 districts across the nation, and Michigan's Upper Peninsula is in the 9th. The Lower Peninsula is in the 7th District and served by the Chicago branch. Neil Kashkari will be in the Upper Peninsula next week for a sort of town hall forum in Houghton, and he joins us now. I understand you're holding these forums all across the district. What are you hoping to accomplish with them?
It's really important for me to get out in the district and hear directly from residents. How are things going? How's the local economy? How's the job market? What are their concerns? A big part of my job is to represent our region when I go back to Washington, D.C., and then we set monetary policy for the nation. And so hearing directly from people who live in the UP is why I'm going there, and I hope people will come out to the town hall.
I'm wondering if it's kind of a head-scratcher for some. I mean, generally speaking, how well does the typical citizen understand what the Fed is, what it's doing for them, and why you're in their town?
Well, that's true. And so part of what I'm doing when I go out to these town halls is educating people about why there is a Fed, how we're focused on monetary policy. We're looking at the job market. We're looking at economic growth. Congress has charged the Fed with keeping an even economy, not too hot, not too cold, and a strong job market. And that's what we're trying to achieve. And even though some of these issues are complicated, people living in the UP will be able to tell me, hey, here's how our job market is. Here's what we're seeing in prices. And it's important for me to hear directly from them.
We all have this vague idea that you're somehow responsible or to blame for the interest rates on our loans, our credit cards, and so forth. How do you explain how the Federal Reserve banking system is relevant to an individual's life as well as the regional economy?
Well, like you just said, it's through that borrowing, those credit costs. So when you go out and you get a mortgage for your house, you can pay more for a mortgage or less. That's one of the ways that the Federal Reserve influences keeping the economy growing. Again, not too hot. If the economy looks like it's overheating, the Fed will raise rates, which will make it more expensive to get a car loan or a home loan or a business loan, and that'll cool things down. If the economy looks like it's going down, then typically the Fed will cut rates to try to make it easier and cheaper to get those loans. So the lending is one of the key ways that we end up influencing the economy.
Yeah, you mentioned that, and I wasn't going to bring this up, but you recently dissented on that with the committee. You want to explain that real quickly to us?
Sure. So the Fed just last week voted to raise interest rates by 0.25%, and I voted against that. And the reason I voted against that is that I think the economy still has room to run. We're not seeing signs of overheating. The job market is getting tighter. I know that. But if you look at inflation, inflation is still running a little bit lower than what we've targeted, which is 2% per year. That tells me we should allow the economy to keep growing and expanding before we start tapping the brakes. That was a judgment call. My colleagues, you know, voted in favor of the increase, and that's why we raised rates.
Well, we're on the subject of the Federal Open Market Committee. That consists of the Reserve Bank presidents like yourself and the Board of Governors. Can you explain those separate parts of the Fed and how they work together or don't work together?
Absolutely. So 100 years ago in 1913, when Congress created the Federal Reserve, they didn't want all the power concentrated in Washington, D.C. So they said, we're going to have a separation of powers, and we're going to have a Board of Governors in Washington that are appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the United States Senate. And then they created 12 independent regional Federal Reserve banks, including the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And the presidents, of which I'm one, I'm not appointed by the President of the United States. I'm appointed by a local board of directors who picked me to help represent this region. So that's a separation. That way we don't have groupthink all in Washington, D.C., all taking the Washington perspective. And that's even more why it's so important for me to hear directly from people in the UP, how's it going? How's the economy? How's the job market? That can help inform my own thinking when I go back to Washington.
Each Fed district puts out a regional beige book, the publication that comes out eight times a year. It includes articles on different economic issues from the region. I was looking at the summary of the latest Minneapolis beige book issued in May, and it read, economic activity grew modestly. The professional services, residential construction, manufacturing, energy, and mining sectors saw growth, while commercial and residential real estate activity declined slightly. Commercial construction increased in some regions but was flat in others and slower in segments outside of multifamily building. Employment and wages both saw moderate growth. How well does the Upper Peninsula fit that economic picture of the entire district?
Well, I think one of the advantages that we have as a district is it's very diverse. So all major sectors of the U.S. economy are represented somewhere across the 9th District. So if some sectors are up, other sectors may be down. The UP is not going to have the same diversity of economic engines that we have over this multi-state region. And so that's why it's important for me to go directly to the UP, hear how things are going. And I was there last year, learned about some of the challenges that they have. And so, you know, I'm here to learn and here to hear from people and give feedback where I can. But I do think the UP is its own region. It's more of a concentrated sector. You're not going to have that diversity. Just like when I go to North Dakota, North Dakota does not have the same diversity. They've got a huge oil patch, which helps them in boom times, but can be challenging when times are tough.
So give us a thumbnail sketch of the Upper Peninsula economy. What are the dominant industries, dominant influences on the economy?
Well, I mean, you look at the natural resources that are up there. You look at the, you know, people, a lot of people go there for vacationing, for second homes, et cetera. There are other challenges that I heard about when I was there last year in terms of electricity rates and some of the competitiveness challenges that they have just based on the geography. So the geography of the Upper Peninsula, as I've seen it, is one of the huge resources, one of the huge features of the UP, but it's also one of the challenges that people face there that they may not face in other parts of the region. And so I need to hear from folks, you know, what are happening to local housing prices? Last time I was there, I heard that it can be really expensive for folks and that there are real constraints there. I also heard about electricity prices, but you know, I want to hear, are things getting better? Are things getting worse? What does the job market look like?
Here in the Lower Peninsula, we think of the UP as timber and mining. Are those as dominant as they once were?
Well, I mean, I think that they still have a very, very large share, but some of those sectors have come under pressure, not just in the UP, but all across the 9th District economy. Some of those sectors that you just mentioned are under pressure, given where commodity prices have fallen over the last few years. You know, relative to their peak several years ago. And so I need to see how the region is adjusting to that and whether or not there are new businesses that are being created to provide those good jobs that people are looking for.
Each Federal Reserve District does its own research for the Beige Book. Who determines what you'll study for each edition of that book, and what's the overall goal?
Well, the overall goal is to get an honest snapshot of what's happening in the regional economy. So we have a very strong team of economic researchers in our bank that do long-term economic research. We also have regional economists and people who travel out across the district, meeting with small business men and women, meeting with banks, large and small, meeting with community leaders to hear what's happening. All of that intel is then brought back together, consolidated, and that's how we produce the Beige Book. By me going out personally, I want to hear directly. I don't want to just hear the secondhand stories. I want to hear directly from citizens what's happening, what are the challenges, what are the opportunities.
So once you bring that in, once you're aware of that, more aware of what's going on in the UP from the residents, what can the Fed do? What can you do to improve the economic plight?
Well, a couple things. One is directly through monetary policy. So as we talked about a few moments ago, in March and again in June, I voted against a rate increase and have been advocating that, you know, we're not seeing the economy overheating. Let's keep rates lower while the economy continues to heal. That's one direct way we can influence the economy. And then second, in some of the longer-term research that we do, we can do analysis that brings forward ideas that other policymakers can carry forward. So I'll give you an example. We just announced a major new research initiative studying economic opportunity and inclusive growth. And the point of this is there are big disparities in our country, in our region, whether it's urban and rural disparities or racial disparities. If we can come up with policy solutions that are beyond monetary policy and put those out in a non-political, non-partisan way, that could then give members of Congress, state legislatures, governors, the information they need to take their own policies forward. So we're looking for every way we can to try to support the U.S. economy and the economy of our region, and we're open to ideas.
I want to ask you about another disparity, and that's there's a lot of concern about income inequality. What's your take on that issue?
I think it's an important issue. I think, you know, as the economy has expanded over the last 30 years, we have seen rising income inequality across our country. And we need an economy that works for everyone, in my opinion. We need an economy that everyone has a fair chance to get a good education, get a good job, and build a better life for themselves. We know the Fed cannot solve all of these problems, but if we can do the research that helps shine a light on them, again, in a non-political, non-partisan way, I think that's an important contribution we can make.
Well, I've got you on the line here. I want to ask you one other thing, and that's what you think of the Choice Act, which is proposed to replace the Dodd-Frank Act, which regulates the banking industry. What are the pros and cons?
Well, we did a major initiative at the Minneapolis Fed focusing on the problem of too-big-to-fail banks. In short, the biggest banks are still too big to fail, and the taxpayers will be on the hook if they get into trouble, and that's a problem from my perspective. So our analysis says the banks need a lot more capital, which is the buffer, the down payment that they make on their investments. That down payment can protect the taxpayers. So the Choice Act recognizes that and encourages banks to have more capital. I would say the Choice Act does not go far enough in increasing the capital requirements on the biggest banks. The Choice Act also has a bunch of other stuff in there on terms of monetary policy and the Federal Reserve that I don't think are good ideas. But in terms of the banks, I do like more capital. But the Choice Act then rolls back a lot of regulations on the big banks that I think probably goes too far. So for me, I would want to see much higher capital requirements for the biggest banks. And if we did that, then we could probably roll back some of these regulations. But I don't want us to be back in a situation like we were in 2008, where the taxpayers had to step in to stabilize the banks.
Neel Kashkari is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis. He's going to be visiting the UP next week in Houghton to talk to the citizens, take some information back to inform the decisions he has to make for us regarding interest rates and other economic issues. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Up next, getting help for victims of human trafficking is harder than it needs to be.
People really want to find out what's out there. There are lots of problems for people. They report not being able to refer individuals to mental health services, to rehab services.
That's next. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In recent years, it seems we've heard a lot more reports of law enforcement cracking down on human trafficking. In Michigan, a researcher says finding victims of human trafficking is different than finding help for those victims. Jessica Lowen is a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Michigan, and she joins us now. And with us on the line is Dina Policicchio. She's Director of Outreach and Education for Alternatives for Girls, a nonprofit in Detroit which serves homeless and high-risk girls and young women. Let's start with the basics. Jessica, how do you determine if someone is a victim of human trafficking?
That really varies. The TVPA, which is the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which was first passed in 2000 and then reauthorized multiple times by the U.S. federal government since then, does outline specific guidelines for what constitutes a victim of trafficking and who is a victim. So it's defined by the crime. So there are multiple elements of the crime. There's force, fraud, and coercion. It has to do with taking advantage of people, forcing them. There's an element of deceit that's happening for the purposes of exploiting their labor in some way, or with sex trafficking victims, for forcing them to transact sexual services. And then certainly any minors who are involved in any kind of transactional sex are going to be automatically counted as trafficking victims.
Dina, in your group's experience, how common is human trafficking?
Well, I would say that varies across the Southeast Michigan landscape, but I think it is an issue that's been with us for a very long time and is more prevalent than we think, but not in the ways we're hearing its high prevalency. And by that, I mean it's more prevalent in high poverty and high vulnerable populations, but not so much in suburban areas of malls and shopping centers.
Without using names, can you give me a couple of example stories of girls or young women you've been able to help?
Sure. And I'll just say this, Alternatives for Girls serves girls and women who have been victims of trafficking and those who are at risk for it. We are not a trafficking-specific organization. And so we've served individuals along that continuum, girls who are about to be trafficked, girls who were trafficked, women who were trafficked at one time and are trying to recover from it. But one story that always haunts me is really just about the vulnerability of young people whose families discard of them, and that's a harsh word, but that's exactly what happens. And she was standing outside at a bus stop waiting. She had just gone into a shelter the night before because her family member had died, and so she was looking for a job. She was going to go find a job, and a man pulled up, and he just said to her, "You're too pretty to be standing here. Can I give you a ride to the bus depot?" Because it was raining, and he wanted to take her there, and sure enough, he gave her that ride. He said, "Let me buy you a meal." And he sat down and he asked her all the right questions. He asked her about why she was there, what was going on in her life. And she talked about a little sister who she loved and that, you know, was being cared for by a family member. And this little sister became his means of exploiting her. He held that over her head. "If I got you, do you think I can get her? I'll kill her, I'll rape her, I'll sell her." And for years, this young woman became first his prostituting victim, and then he used her to recruit other girls and actually abuse other girls later on. If not for a very wise and compassionate prosecuting attorney, she would have been in jail as a pimp because all the girls identified her as the primary recruiter. But when this prosecutor looked at her and said, "Oh my goodness, you're actually a victim too," and took the care and time, and she wound up in our one-of-a-kind program that helps people get out of the industry. We watched her blossom. She went to college. She has a job. She has a family now. And that's what it takes. It takes a sort of cultural mind shift of looking at people as prostitutes, as perpetrators of crime, and recognize that not everybody who sells themselves is doing it by choice, that the force behind it can be crippling and prevent you from doing anything else in your life.
When you help them, you assist them in finding resources. What kind of gaps are there in the system as far as, you know, identifying people who can help?
Gaps that exist would be funding for long-term mental health care. This is not something that you heal from overnight. Especially take that young woman's story that I just shared. She was traumatized for over 6 years, beaten, raped, manipulated. She had to perpetrate violence against other girls. That mental health trauma against her is not something that you can cure in 30 to 90 days. It's something that takes a long time, and recognizing that long-term care. Other service gaps would not just be for girls and women. Boys and men are sexually exploited as well. And there aren't the same amount of services for them because it's not the same kind of focus on them. And then lastly, it's a long-term advocacy around jobs. People don't like to hire individuals with criminal histories. Either we change the laws to make sure that these women and girls, men and boys, get jobs later on, or we change the cultural mindset of hiring people with criminal histories and recognizing you may have been forced through circumstances or actual physical or psychological force and need a new opportunity to do a different thing, to be a positive member of society.
Jessica, you're working to identify more resources, mm-hmm. services, I mean, help for these human trafficking victims. What are you doing to come up with a more comprehensive list of services?
Well, one thing, Lester, that I have been doing is to collect contact information for various organizations that are involved in anti-trafficking efforts in the state of Michigan. And I've been able to do that by leveraging contacts that I've made over the last few years of doing ethnographic research among anti-trafficking activists in the Detroit area specifically. People really want to find out what's out there. There are lots of problems for people. They report not being able to refer individuals to mental health services, to rehab services, and there are lots of gaps in that way. So what I've been doing is building off of those referral lists and finding new organizations that potentially provide services that would be helpful to human trafficking victims, in the last month, I've been running the Michigan Human Trafficking Resource Survey, and we've distributed to about 300 contacts throughout the state of Michigan. We're hoping to get many more people to respond. The target audience for that is health and human service providers, advocates, survivor groups, nonprofit organizations, churches, lots of stakeholders who are involved in offering services to assist.
So there's not a comprehensive list now? I mean, nobody's compiled the list?
No.
Why hasn't that happened?
When I first started this project a few years ago, people began to approach me because they heard I was just keeping a list for my own record. I'd meet multiple people. I was interested in what they were doing, and I had this Excel spreadsheet. People would ask, would you share that with me? I need to have that information. I don't know where to send people. And lots of these organizations, like Dina can tell you, maintain their own referral lists. Referral lists get outdated. There's so many new groups that are popping up. And after the third time of being asked for this list, I finally heard people's request that there wasn't a sense of what was going on in the state of Michigan. We just really don't know how many groups are out there providing services, where services are being provided, for whom, how people are accessing them. So I believe there's been a few efforts in the past to try to collect this information, but they really haven't gone anywhere. So I finally just said, all right, I'm going to do it.
So this online survey is up now.
It is. It is.
We'll put the website on our website.
Thank you.
So you can find it there. I want to ask you about the time you spent in the field in your research, trying to identify victims of human trafficking. Where does that take you?
I shadow outreach, so sites where sex is sold in Detroit. So there are some street-based situations. There are areas in Detroit that are known for a high frequency of prostitution. Also, adult entertainment venues, often referred to as strip clubs, and going with people who are trying to intervene in those situations and watching them working with them, really getting to see the way that they're able to build connections with people that work there. I've learned a lot. It's been pretty amazing. It's an incredible group of people, the kind of individuals that spend their time in their evenings going out into situations to build connections with people, not for the purposes of telling them what they're doing is wrong, but to tell them, listen to them, invite them to leave. Alternatives for Girls also does great outreach, and they are connecting with people that provide people with referral information and harm reduction services.
How successful are those attempts to reach out to those victims? I mean, do you get a small fraction, or are you fairly successful?
Well, I guess I would just say that's a complicated question in how you define success. But to your point, it is a small percentage. Most activities, they're illegal, so they're hidden. And so even the best outreach efforts can't always reach the most vulnerable moments and situations. But to the individuals we're able to reach, success is very degreed. I feel it's a success when somebody doesn't walk away and actually stands and listens and talks to you. Some people don't define success until that person is no longer exchanging sex, but that's a very simplistic way of looking at it, because if somebody just really does not love herself or indeed is being forced to do something beyond her control, you can't just define success as being able to leave. You have to define success as that she is, one, able to conceptualize that she is deserving of doing something else, and two, able to conceptualize and actualize the doing of something else. Because if there's force involved, either emotional or physical, that may be actually impossible in a lot of ways to do without jeopardizing her own life or the lives of others.
That's Dina Policicchio with Alternatives for Girls, which helps homeless and high-risk girls and young women. And we've been talking to Jessica Lowen. She's coordinating the Michigan Human Trafficking Resource Survey in an effort to create a comprehensive list of organizations and services to help victims of human trafficking. We will have that website on our website, michiganradio.org. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Lester.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now joining us, as they do most Fridays, are Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate via Skype, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Okay, let's see if I got this straight. Governor Rick Snyder wanted a tax incentive package to lure big employers. A majority of Republicans and Democrats liked the idea, but the Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard, yanked the legislation to do that because of a rumor that the governor had cut a deal with Democrats for their support. Ken, isn't cutting deals and compromise kind of part of how politics work? What's going on here?
Well, it is. But I think what we're witnessing here is really the tension in Republican ranks over this whole concept of special incentives to lure these big business projects.
And sure. Some of them call it corporate welfare.
Well, the people that disparage it, the Republicans that disparage it, call it either corporate cronyism or corporate welfare. But that tension and debate has existed since the early days of John Engler, when he campaigned against the idea of special incentives, but then realized that in a competitive world with other states, it's just Michigan had to have this tool in its toolbox. But that's really what I think you're seeing here, is that historical tension in Republican ranks over this whole concept.
Vicky, bipartisan support for anything in Lansing is not a typical day. Who wins, who loses when the speaker refuses to call a vote on something that the majority wants?
Well, first, I want to say that bipartisan support on most bills is the normal course of the day. These kinds of bills where there is political party tension that's injected into the debate are the ones that cause the rift between the two parties on the floor of the House and the Senate. I agree with Ken that there are some problems with the governor and his leadership team in the House and the Senate. But I think this is a bigger problem. And I think Speaker Leonard pulled the bills because he was more concerned that there was a deal cut to protect some union and Democratic issues for a veto from the governor should they pass in the House and the Senate. And I think that's the bigger issue. And Speaker Leonard was very clear that he felt this was undermining his agenda. I still think that this was a bad move on the part of the Speaker. This shows the real problem with term limits and inexperienced leadership. When you have a bill that's supported bipartisanly in the House, in the Senate, and finally got out of committee with some bipartisan amendments, and then was brought to the floor with the expectation it would be voted on and passed so that the state could immediately move on bringing some good jobs to Michigan. If this is really about good jobs, as the bill package is titled, shouldn't the legislature be working for the people of the state of Michigan and providing opportunities for jobs and good jobs instead of worrying about petty politics behind the scenes?
Let's turn to another topic. The state learned of an undisclosed conflict of interest by a firm that was analyzing Enbridge Energy's Line 5 pipeline. That's the oil and gas pipeline that runs under the Straits of Mackinac. Basically, an employee was doing that work for the state and also work for Enbridge. So the state canceled the contract. That's all fine. But Ken, we don't have a report on whether the 64-year-old pipeline is safe or a risk now. So where does this leave Michigan?
Well, we're sort of in a catch-22 situation. As you pointed out, there's two reports that have to be done. One is the risk assessment. That's the one that got canceled. And then there's a report coming out regarding possible alternatives. But no matter what happens at the end of the day, I mean, the state will have to get another contract, do another risk assessment. But I think the average citizen of Michigan is going to question whether any risk is okay when it comes to having an oil pipeline under the straits. I mean, the issue of whether something's safe versus whether it's risk-free are just two different issues. Safety is a relative term. I mean, is it safe to drive on the expressway this morning? But there's no such thing as no risk for a pipeline under the straits. But I think most Michigan citizens are just going to say, you know, whatever the risk, however infinitesimal that might be, it just isn't worth it to have it under the Straits of Mackinac.
Vicky, this contract termination seems to be bringing up more questions than answers. I mean, how did the state become aware of this conflict of interest? Why was it revealed so late in the process? What's the way forward? What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's highly unfortunate that there was a breach in the protocol in doing this particular assessment by the company. This was for a risk assessment of what costs would be needed to clean up a spill and do all the remediation necessary. The other study that is going forward is the one that would look at alternatives to the Enbridge pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac. And I think that is probably a more important one, because we need to know how much the cost would be to get rid of the pipeline, Enbridge 5 line, and shut it down. It's been a pipeline that's been there for 63 years. It has been in the past in breach of the easement requirements that it signed when it laid that pipeline. For example, there's supposed to be supports and anchors to the lake bed every 75 feet. There was a period of 16 years where not only did it exceed 75 feet, but there were 16 breaches of 140 feet or more where that pipeline was not secured to the lake bed. I'm not sure if those processes have been put in place to fix that. I've been told that they have been, but still for many years it was unsupported and it caused a bend in the pipeline. And that bend can breach the integrity of the entire pipeline. So we know that there are problems down there and we need to address it quickly before there is an oil spill.
That's Vicki Burnett. She's a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. Thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
And in the interest of full disclosure, Enbridge Energy is a financial supporter of Michigan Radio. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. We were talking earlier of the contract that the state terminated with an independent contractor that was analyzing the risk of Enbridge Energy's Line 5 pipeline. It leaves a lot of unanswered questions. The state says the company, Det Norske Veritas, a Norwegian firm, failed to follow conflict of interest rules. An employee of the firm was working on the state's request for an at-risk analysis of the 64-year-old pipeline, and then he did some work for Enbridge. Joining us now to hopefully shed some light on this is Valerie Brader. She's the executive director of the Michigan Agency for Energy. Was it your office which was responsible for finding a firm qualified to do this work?
Well, there was an effort by the Attorney General, the Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of Natural Resources, and my agency all together that actually had the request for proposal process, selected the contractor and entered into this. And along the way, we were really blessed with the guidance of the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board as well in looking at the proposals and also shaping the statements of work.
So when and how did you learn about this conflict of interest?
Well, we were first notified that there might be one in late May, and the staff then spent some time working with the contractor to determine what had happened, what the scope of it was, what the work was that might have been affected, and really tried to get the contractor to propose some solutions to this. The solutions that were proposed just in our mind were not going to cure the fundamental problem. And last week we decided the reports were going to be unusable. We didn't have any drafts to date, but just realized that that was the risk analysis was just not going to be usable given the tremendous importance of having a conflict-free product.
Who tipped you off? Who told you that there might be this conflict?
The contractor did report it to us.
How long had the firm been working on this analysis before the contract was terminated?
For more than 6 months.
Wow. I'm just wondering how this firm could allow this conflict of interest to occur. I mean, usually you know what contracts all your employees are working on, and somebody's, you know, checking for a conflict of interest like that. What happened?
Well, you know, this was something before we hired them that we asked all the contractors, and they had pledged to us that nobody who worked on our project would work on anything for Enbridge during the time that the project was ongoing. And clearly that violated this. But our own contract with them went even farther than that. So that was sort of what they offered. But our contract actually required them to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. And obviously, this did neither. It didn't fulfill what they had promised us to do, and it certainly went way beyond what they were required by our contract to do. So,
did the state have to give a down payment or anything? Are the taxpayers out of any money?
So all of this money actually came originally from Enbridge into an escrow fund that's controlled by the state. So this isn't originally taxpayer dollars, but actually the contractor had not invoiced us, and so no funds have been paid to date to this contractor.
I understand there aren't that many firms qualified to do this kind of risk assessment of pipelines, which aren't actually energy companies themselves. So how difficult will it be to find another firm to do this work?
So we did have other bidders when we originally put this out. We have an entirely different firm that is slated to give a draft of the alternative analysis that we will release by the end of the month. So we'll have to look at all of our options. That certainly, you know, we still definitely need some information, and we need to be thinking about our best and speediest way to get it.
Yeah, speed is a real big concern. I mean, how long could this take, finding the firm, getting the firm to do the work, and getting a report? We're talking another 8 months or so? Or
that is certainly the state did not do this because we had a wonderful plan B that could immediately be executed. We did this because their work was simply no longer usable with the violation result. But in terms of the speed, it certainly is of the essence. The process of originally putting out the RFP, finding the contractor, and having them do the work has been a lengthy one. So we will be brainstorming and consulting with lots of people to figure out how we get this work done in a way that has integrity, but also as speedily as possible. So we don't know that plan of action today, but as soon as we have some possible courses of action, I'm sure that we'll be putting those in front of lots of folks to ask for their advice on how to best move forward.
Yeah, I don't have to tell you, there's a lot of concern about this pipeline. It really came under scrutiny after the Enbridge pipeline broke and caused the largest inland oil spill in the nation's history in the Kalamazoo River. Enbridge Energy is saying it inspected the twin pipelines of Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac, and the company says it's fine. I don't think there are very many people in the state comforted by those reassurances. The question, I guess, is what is the state going to do about this 64-year-old pipeline now?
Well, the good thing is that the contractor who's actually performing the alternatives analysis, which is the thing that's supposed to say, so what are our options? They go from continuing to use this pipe to shutting it down completely and a lot of things in between. And it has, as part of it, an independent engineering analysis. There is no indication that there has been any problem with them adhering to the very strict conflict of interest. So that report should be out for the public to comment on, give us ways to improve it, note any data that's missing, any parts that are confusing. All of that work will still be continuing in July. And so that's obviously very important work. The report that we were hoping to release this week that is obviously not going to be now was really going just to the financial magnitude of a worst-case spill. And in my mind, while it's still very important that we get that to be able to set the right insurance levels and some other things, whether it's a $1 billion or a $20 billion, we all know that that would be devastating to the Great Lakes. And so to me, that alternatives analysis report, still being able to move forward with that is really valuable and important, and we're glad to be able to do that.
Valerie Brader heads up the Michigan Agency for Energy. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
That alternative analysis, that report that is being completed and released, will be presented on July 6th at Holt High School. There will be other briefings in other cities later. There will also be a video of that presentation online. You can find out more information on MichiganRadio.org. Just click on Stateside. The legislature has passed a budget. Here to hit some of the main points are Kyle Malin, editor of MERS, a news agency that covers state government, and Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau chief for Michigan Radio. First, let me ask you guys, any more money for schools?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. the short answer. I mean, there's a little bit more additional for schools. If you're looking at the state allocation that's given to local school districts, it's an additional $60 to $120 dollars per student. It's the most per pupil funding that we've had in the state of Michigan. The floor will be $7,100, which is the highest floor that we've had.
We should point out it's sort of a political imperative in the budget making process that they should always be able to say this is the most funding that's ever been devoted to schools, the most per student funding.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, because as inflation goes up, as the cost of living and everything else goes up, so does the cost of education. And so they were able to make that claim this year, as they were with universities, community colleges, and just in general, the entire education package, which they all put into something I've referred to as the school bus. And so that was one of the big claims that was made out of this budget for Republicans, was that this is the biggest budget that we've ever had for education and the most money we spent on roads since Obama gave us all that stimulus money back in 2009. But I think what's most interesting about this budget is that it's a reflection of what we're seeing with the economy, this kind of like slow prodding, slow growth that we've experienced. I mean, it's nothing spectacular. It's nothing that you can go, wow, about. But it just is kind of a reflection of where we are as a state right now.
Yeah, really the most controversial part of the budget was putting money into the teacher pension system to sort of further the transition from a defined benefit system, traditional pensions, to defined contribution, 401k style. Those were really the big fireworks in the budget process.
All right, before we go on here, I need to clarify one thing. You said $60 or $120. Who gets the one amount and who gets the other?
Well, it's determined by this something they call this 2X formula, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but usually those kind of rural districts that got the 120 and kind of the suburbanite districts that got the 60.
And don't forget the $500 million for at-risk funding.
I saw that at-risk funding. That was interesting. I didn't know that was even being debated.
Well, and that was substantial, too, because they also broadened the pot of the people who are able to get some of that at-risk funding. So not only did they increase the amount that is for at-risk, they kind of widened that net out so more schools are able to take care or take advantage of that special pot of money.
Let me ask you about, you mentioned roads. We've got a little more money of roads, right? What happened there?
A little more for roads, yeah.
Okay. Department of Corrections budget was cut. How much and why?
That was cut a little bit. They're going to end up shutting down 5 units within the Department of Corrections. No prisons, but just units within certain prisons.
Which was a big fight between the Senate Republicans and the governor and the Department of Corrections. That the department isn't saying that a prison won't necessarily get shut down in the coming year, but that needs to be a decision that's made by the corrections professionals and not a decision that's forced on the department by the legislature.
Because what we're seeing is fewer prisoners, fewer inmates in state penitentiaries. And so the point is here is that we want to get people rehabilitated. We want to get them out and be productive members of the society as opposed to just sitting in a prison somewhere. So there have been conscious policy decisions that have been made throughout the years that have lowered the prison population. So we are now at a point where we are cutting back on prisons because there's just fewer of them in them.
Now, municipalities have been complaining for a long time that they're getting less revenue sharing. What's happened in the budget this year?
They got about a 2.5% bump. It's the first bump, I think, Kyle, in 3 years?
Yeah, I think
so. Yeah.
And Snyder originally wasn't going to give them anything because he said because of the personal property tax refunds, the way that system went, these local units of government were getting more money as opposed to collecting that personal property tax on equipment for manufacturing, the replacement mechanism they created was actually giving them more money. So Snyder said, hey, you guys don't need any more money. But
they pushed back. And they got something. And this matters in part because, you know, all of the entities that rely on revenue sharing, you know, that ancient deal where the state will collect the taxes, but then distribute them back to the local governments. And, you know, local governments, municipalities, counties have been crying foul on that for a while, saying the state's been shortchanging them. What they're hoping to set up is a debate probably that will take place this coming fall to revamp the system for revenue sharing, for how local governments get revenue from the state, and they consider this a good, promising first step.
Let me talk about something else that happened with the budget. The legislature took millions of dollars from the Unemployment Insurance Contingent Fund. The state of Michigan had this debacle where it was wrongly accusing people of taking unemployment when they weren't eligible, caused all kinds of havoc in people's lives, including some people who had to file bankruptcy because of this state foul-up.
Well, not only did they have to pay back the money, but there was also a 400% penalty.
So a lot of people were hurt. Taking money out of the unemployment insurance to shore up the state's bank account just looks wrong. What were they thinking?
Well, I think what they were looking at here is that we've got some programs that are trying to get people into skilled trades and to get them training to get back into the workforce. And so they saw this surplus in the fund as a way to invest money into those programs. And the legislature actually went above and beyond the governor's proposal of about $48 million. And I think they're up to 72, somewhere in that area. $72 million from this unemployment fund that you just mentioned has gone now into a couple of different programs designed to try and get people back into the workforce in some type of skilled trades program or profession. And, that was certainly a big talking point. When we asked the Republican leaders about that, they said, hey, look, if a court finds that we owe people a bunch of money, we'll pay people that bunch of money. And if it, whether it comes out of this fund, if there's not enough money in that fund, we'll find money somewhere.
Well, if these workers win the case and it's in the court of claims, then, you know, the $60 million that's the surplus could very well be just a fraction of what they're owed by the time you get through with paying them back plus plus punitive damages. And I think that's what the leadership was talking about, which is, you know, look, we're going to have to find it somewhere. So let's deal with today's problems today and tomorrow's problems tomorrow.
Rick Pluta is Michigan Radio Capital Bureau Chief, and Kyle Malin is editor of MERS. Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
50 years ago next month, Detroit exploded into 5 days of violent unrest. The city is still grappling with what happened in that long, hot summer of 1967. A new exhibit at the Detroit Historical Museum digs deep into the history of the uprising and looks at how it's shaped the city ever since. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick talked with the Detroit Historical Society's Rebecca Salmanen-Witt about the exhibit. Witt says it's been in the works for more than 2 years.
One of the first things that they realized was that to do this subject matter justice, we had to do our business as a historical society a little differently. We needed to reach out into the community, get their stories, get their perspectives, understand how they felt about it and what they remembered about it. So you go knock on people's doors and you sit in their living rooms and you hear their stories. We've collected nearly 500 oral histories so far. The things that we chose to highlight in the exhibition itself are the things that came up over and over again in people's memories because we knew those were the significant stories that had to be told. Well, I think if we go right up here and we see Detroit's Real Race Riot, when people call it a race riot in 1967, they're wrong. We did have a race riot. It happened in 1943. Different races are rioting against each other. And in 1967, the races were rioting together. And so that's, like, you know, pretty essential difference. As we get closer to the summer of 1967, a lot of this deals with kind of that promise that brought people to Detroit. And many people think that it's that broken promise, which is really the most significant root cause. Some of that is really around people came here expecting great jobs. They heard of Detroit as a place where segregation wasn't happening in the same way, where racism was over. And when they got here, they found out that wasn't really true. And that broken expectation was really difficult for folks to swallow, I think. This area is the living room. We call it the living room. It's set up like a living room because many people experienced the uprising in 1967 from their living room. What we do is take you through kind of on the television screens what you would have been seeing. There was a media blackout for a couple of days, and so you see a lot of children's programming and just kind of random things that would have been on TV at that time. And then it starts progressing, and you start to see the news reports picking up. So the images that they chose to broadcast affected greatly what people understood about what was happening. The fact that there were very few images of any white people looting was a significant thing. There were absolutely white people looting. They just didn't show it on TV. 12th and Claremont was a bustling commercial district. It was decimated. Lots of places in the community. The photo that we're looking at here is from Holy Trinity Parish, where some nuns are distributing canned goods. So there were a lot of pieces of that community that just stepped up to support its neighbors. The conversations that are happening as a result of this work and that will continue to happen as a result of the exhibition, we think we would be further ahead now if those conversations had been being had for the past 50 years. And we think there's some great promise where there is enough good things happening in the city of Detroit that people want to get together and talk this through and become a different kind of community. And if this exhibition helps power that initiative forward, it will have been a real success.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Claire Bryan, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Candy. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.